Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Camille Terry. She is the co-founder and CEO of Charger Help, a company in the business of repairing broken EV chargers. There may be as many as 30% of EV chargers that are inoperable. The company started here in LA. Charger Help is now repairing chargers in almost 20 states. Happy to have Camille on the podcast today. Hi, Camille. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ted. It's so great to be here.
Very good to meet you. And where are you sitting as we speak?
I am currently in Los Angeles, California.
That's home, right? That's been home your whole life, I take it.
For the most part, I did a short, like, 5-year stint in Philadelphia. But other than that, yeah, I've been here in LA.
Yeah, very good. And I've introduced you as the co-founder and now the CEO of Charger Help. And we're going to get way into it. And I just always start off by asking, what are you working on this week? What's hot? What's the focus?
So this week, we are currently working on software integration. So NLX, which is a software company in our industry, recently announced that they will be going out of business. And so there are currently customers across the U.S., that has this software and they need to transition to a new software. This is the first time that something like this has happened for a major software provider. So the industry, we're kind of like all hands on deck, supporting the industry in this transition.
But you're using this software to manage your network of charger repairs. Is that right?
So we are actually the boots on the ground that are helping to switch over the software. So we are the folks that, interestingly enough, sometimes in order to move software to software, you actually can't do it over the air, at least not yet. And so we have to dispatch out technicians to be physically in front of charging stations to change over the software.
Oh, I see. I see. Oh, how interesting. And that sounds like thousands and thousands of chargers.
164,000 in North America, to be exact.
Now, I saw that I know you've been growing rapidly. You founded your company in 2020. And are you in like about 20 states now? Is that about right?
17 regions. We learned very early on that, covering the entire area of Texas is a little hard. So we call them 17 regions, but essentially, part of about 17 states. Yeah.
God, that's incredible. That's incredible. How did you get into this? What was it that I know you worked for? Was it EV Connect for a number of years? And that's another EV charging company, right? Is that what did the light just sort of go off and you just said, hey, wait a second, there's so many chargers that are not in service. Somebody's got to do something about this.
I think it started a little, probably even younger than that. My dad started his own company when he was 24, and he used to build out server rooms in Los Angeles for a lot of doctors here in LA before the cloud. My dad actually thinks the cloud is weird, and he feels like everyone should have their server room. but I grew up around computers, grew up around even that time period. There was a lot of firmware issues and viruses. And so that is just how I've always understood software. When I had the opportunity to work at EV Connect, I started off as EV driver support. And it was really interesting to me that we would have drivers that would explain a certain behavior of the station that I sometimes could not validate or recreate on my backend software. And so it kind of piqued this interest for me that there was like this data set that the protocol that we were using as an industry was not capturing. And so that then led into why we see some issues that take longer to solve, why it's hard to troubleshoot issues, and why we really aren't at a place that you can really do a lot more around just sending over their updates. And so that's kind of like where all this started out for me. And when I, left EV Connect, I saw that it wasn't just an EV Connect issue. It was an industry-wide issue. There was a larger opportunity here.
This is you're obviously so techie. You're revealing yourself quickly, which I admire. But here's a naive question. I thought when we have about 30% of all the EV chargers around the country that are not working, they're for one reason or another, they're inoperable. I just thought that was all hardware. I thought that, you know, the cords were stolen or whatever, but I think you're going to tell me that a lot of those are software issues.
Yeah, we actually see it closer to maybe about, I would say, high 80s, probably creeping into 90% of these issues are actually software interoperability issues. And last year, I had the opportunity to visit about 5 countries. And in these other countries, their uptime is closer to about 95%. But that last 5% are what some of the network provider calls it needle in a haystack software issues. And so, no, charging stations are computers. We've kind of like put computers on highways and byways, and sometimes they don't work. And,
right.
There's an opportunity there.
So this is not just a matter of rolling trucks, right? This is a matter of you having trouble, you having a big staff of people that can do remote troubleshooting of software.
Well, even, yeah, so correct. So charging issues, this is not a labor problem. And even more interestingly, you know, what we're looking at building out is more similar to like a machine learning, utilizing, you know, technology to learn from a large data set in order to solve issues over the air, right? And what we realized is that when you do go out and troubleshoot something, how much information can you gather from the field? And what is, and most importantly, what information can you gather that the station itself cannot tell you? And if you get enough of that information, what patterns are there? What have you learned? Yeah. And are there key things that you can now change to then eventually get to a place where you can fix things over the air? And the last thing I'll say is that technology is forever changing and evolving. So it is not something that I think that you can just learn, right? It is this natural problem set that you have to combine big data, machine learning, and people in order to really get to high reliability.
Yeah. Now you mentioned that you were in 5 other countries, I think you said, and they have like 95% uptime on their chargers. Are those European countries, or where is that, and how do they do that? How do they achieve that? That seems fantastic.
Sure. So I was in different European countries. I did London, Germany, France. I was in Japan, and then I'm missing one. But the interesting thing about the rest of the world is that we actually have a more of a fragmented system here in the US. So in the rest of the world, most of the time, there's one main network provider that is essentially the system that everyone's interacting with. So you have less points of failure. In the US, you know, Tesla is the only system that, you know, they make the software for the car, the connector, the payment, the hardware. And so if there's an issue, that is all within the same company. There is no other system like that in the US. There's different software protocols, different companies. And so if there is a problem, it usually is, whose problem is it? And most of the time, naturally so, folks are like, it's not my problem.
Yeah.
And so we end up with a lot of finger pointing because we don't have enough information to properly identify where problems are actually occurring.
But now you are working with all of, you know, a variety of charging companies, but not Tesla, I presume, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, so we actually had a contract with Tesla. My earlier assessment contracts we did with Tesla. We haven't done anything with them recently, but I believe maybe about a year or two ago, we did an audit on their California sites and gave them back data insight on specifically what they call their destination charging stations. Those are level 2 charging stations that typically hotels acquired from them.
Yeah. Now you're working with, are you working with DC fast chargers as well as level 2?
We actually primarily work with DC fast chargers. I prefer those stations because they're the most interesting problem set to me. There's more things that can go wrong with the DC fast charger.
So walk us through then, how does a typical incident occur? You have contracts, say, for a number of chargers, and you're monitoring them to make sure that they're working, and then you're working to fix the ones that are not, or do you get a call on each one that's broken, or how does that work?
Sure. So we sell an insurance-like product that we call Reliability as a Service. We've amassed over 19 million unique data points from the field, as well as have touched over 25,000 charging stations across literally all of the major network providers and manufacturers. And so what we were able to develop is what we call a breakage rate. And so we utilize that breakage rate in order to provide a fixed cost for O&M. So I can tell, you know, a utility, somebody that is in charge of procurement, I can say, hey, because off of my experience, you know, I'm not saying this when our data set sales, you said, oh, you have this hardware, you have this software, the breakage rate is probably X. I can give you a contract, a 5-year contract on this amount to keep your uptime at 97% or higher. And that includes labor, that fixed cost. And so once we sign a station up, we intercept the data in real time. So we can actually validate and acknowledge if there are issues, and then we will proactively try to solve issues over the air. And if we cannot solve an issue over the air, then we will actually send out a field service technician or W-2 employees to solve that issue, get more data, so the next time we could potentially solve it over the air. But it really allows the industry to have a fixed O&M cost, which they have not had before, and then responsibility for the ongoing upkeep of this asset.
And how I work with a lot of cities, small, medium-sized cities. I mean, would you have a contract with the city, or is that too small for you? Is there a minimum number of chargers that you would need to be looking after?
So in our current territories, there is not a minimum number. So in the 17 areas that we're a part of, it's not a minimum number. Our primary customers, though, have been utilities, specifically investor-owned utilities, fleet operators, and then channel partners. We do have some cities, but what we have found, honestly, Ted, which is so interesting, a lot of cities are just very confused about EV charging in general, you know, and so trying to understand what O&M package and charge, it's a lot, right? Yeah. And so we've been working with like climate mayors and the mayor's association to try to figure out how do we better support cities with the deployment of EV charging infrastructure.
Right. But now, do you, and you're just on the O&M side. You haven't gone into the installation side of...
Oh, no. Yeah, oh, I'm a data nerd. Installation is a little too boring for me. I mean, it's fine. I think people do it. But what we're interested in is solving IoT asset problems. We're interested in big, slimy, complex software interoperability failures. Like, that's what gets me going in the morning.
Well, and I was, you know, you answered it early off in our discussion where you talked about your father and, you know, running this computer business and, you know, or dealing with these data servers for these companies. And I thought, how did you get to where you are? And then it seemed like, I want to go digress a little bit into your background, but you went to Azusa Pacific College and, you know, organizational leadership was your major, and you were in multi-ethnic leadership, student government, Black Student Union, Latin American Student Union, Black Women United, speech and debate team, student ambassador. Did you have time for any courses?
I did it all.
You did it all. I mean, but you're obviously on the go, and your leadership is in your blood. So somehow you've taken this computer nerdy, you know, fascinating background and blended it with your personality and your leadership skills, right? It's this combination that's put you in this position that you're in today.
No, absolutely. I mean, I, one, enjoy people, and I enjoy being able to figure out how to, like, solve hard problems. It's just how I'm wired, I guess.
Yeah. Now, how do you train your staff to do this?
So we actually worked with the Society of Automotive Engineers very early on, and they helped us put together essentially a group of industry leaders from, we had ABB, Electrify America, Rivian, Tesla, and we looked at our curriculum, which I had developed early on, and we said, okay, what's important to the industry? And if we wanted to provide a certification for an EVSC technician, what can we agree on that these folks need to have? And Society of Automotive Engineers, led by Frank, has been incredible in a lot of industries of bringing competitors together to come to consensus, right? And so about 2 years ago, we came up with this body of knowledge, and then SAE turned it into a test that is now at the Pearson Testing Centers. So it's crazy, Ted. You can go take your SAT, your ACT, or you could get certified as an EVSC technician, which is wild to me. So we train folks ourselves, but now folks can go take EVSC certification classes with their local community colleges, or they can study the body of knowledge and actually get that first set of certification through the SAE organization.
And so are they this unique combination of people that both like computers and you know, sort of information technology and like to go out into the field?
Yes. And you hit the nail on the head because it's just, I mean, listen, when I first was at EV Connect, sometimes I would have to go out in the field to solve issues because we were a little company and we didn't really have technicians. And it's, I mean, I'm telling you, it's hard. You may have a site host yelling at you. It may be hot. You have to sit on the phone for it. It's a different type of human that can do that. But yeah, you have to enjoy both. And we've been so surprised to see that there is such a desire from a lot of folks transitioning from other industries, oil and gas, cable, telecom, that are excited to be a part of like this new green job.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You touched on Tesla, and I was impressed that you did some work for Tesla because I thought that was sort of totally separate. But how do you see, you know, as you look out 5 years into the future or 10 years, or maybe just five, things are moving so fast. I mean, Elon Musk has talked about opening up his charger network to all EVs. I mean, what does that do? What does that do? Does that, do we all have Tesla chargers or do we still have ChargePoint and all the other brands out there? What do you think?
Oh man, I think this is truly where the consumer and capitalism will play a huge part, right? I think that while you do have government subsidies coming in, I don't think that's something that will continue to carry this industry. You do need the private sector to step in, which I think they have been. But now with the private sector and more consumers purchasing electric vehicles, and they're purchasing electric vehicles not necessarily because they care about the environment. Folks I've heard purchase them because they like the car. But what that then does to this industry, it pressure tests it, right? Because then you have to be concerned about customer experience. That has to be your number one priority. And I think for our industry for a long time, our number one priority was deployment because the capital was coming in from the federal government, utility commission. Yeah. It wasn't about consumer choice. But now with consumer choice coming in, I think a lot of the companies may not exist anymore. I think there's going to be new companies. I think that is going to require us to build a better industry.
And hopefully one that's just super easy for everybody to use.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I know that I sort of shy away from public charging stations just because I'm not signed up to all the different networks and kind of don't want to sign up sort of on my handheld device when I'm running late for a meeting somewhere. And
It's so inconvenient.
And I got to hand it to the Tesla network. It's just so simple. Just pull up and plug in and that's that, right?
Yes. I mean, it's so funny. Like everyone, most of the folks on my team, we have Teslas, not because we like love Elon Musk or anything. It's literally because it's a better experience. And we know how bad the rest of the infrastructure is. So, but I would love to get like a GM Lyric. Like that's what I really want, you know, but I got to wait for the infrastructure to get better.
Yeah. Now, even on the Tesla superchargers, we have a Bolt and we also have a Tesla. But on the Tesla superchargers, on the way from here to Los Angeles to Las Vegas, you pull into one of these stations, they'll have like, 80 chargers there. But you know what? A lot of them are not working. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that is. I mean, is that the same thing? Is that a software? Is there a software glitch going on? And those chargers need to be individually reprogrammed, do you think?
I mean, I've experienced issues right here in LA on Tesla superchargers where the vehicle and the car were saying completely two different things. I think that there is a lot that is happening there from a software side. Like, yeah, it could be.
Yeah. So all chargers are you know, fundamentally have.
Yeah.
It's like a computer has an issue, So.
Yeah.
So does Tesla opening up their charging to the rest of the, to other EVs, what do you think that does to the market?
I think it's going to force us to really start treating the field as the lab. You know, a lot of these companies work in a lab where they're testing their software, testing interoperability. But what we continue to see is that, yeah, things can work in a lab, but once you've deployed, you know, infrastructure and you're deploying new firmware updates to different cars, how that car now works on that station, you know, may be different. And how do you get that data from the field? How do you utilize that to better understand software deployment? So I think it's going to force our hand in thinking about how do we continue to learn, you know, past deployment. And here's the thing, Ted, like that's very interesting to me is that you know, bringing software into the built environment and charging stations, this is just the first step, right? We want to have these smart corridors. We want autonomous vehicles. So us understanding this and being able to problem solve in a different way than we've done before is incredibly important for our future, period, right? Not just charging infrastructure.
Yeah, well put, well put. Now, look, let's talk about the business side. It sounds like you've raised a lot of money for your company.
Yes, it's something that I'm not, I mean, I guess, yeah, I guess you get proud of it. What I'm excited for is to start making even more revenue. We have raised a good amount of money that has allowed us to scale and get on a pathway to do very well from a revenue perspective.
But now this speaks to your entrepreneurial spirit, right? And your guts, right?
You've been out there
raising money and talk about that. Is it hard to do? Has it been hard to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. When I first started the company, like I said, my dad's owned this company since he was in his 20s. And in my first set of capital, I actually did it through pitch competitions, $500,000 during COVID. I pitched at all these places and got $500,000 to get my prototype together. But when I went out to raise my first big set of money, my dad was just like, people are giving you money and you don't have revenue yet. Like, he just couldn't understand it because he's built like a regular, you know, business. And he was just, you know, was very critical about me making sure I understood my business economics and my business unit and just things at that time when folks were raising capital back in 2021, where we say like oceans of money was just flowing. It wasn't things that investors were forcing me to think about. Investors were saying, well, how much more do you need and how can you go faster and spend it all immediately? Fast forward to where we are now as an industry. Now they're like, what are your business unit economics? Why did you spend all of your money? And so it's coming back to just like those fundamentals. So, I mean, fundraising has been interesting, but I think this last set of fundraising, we're closing a corporate round right now. In this environment, you know, it goes back to what my dad was pushing on me. It was just like, I need to be more concerned about my customers, my customer experience, what my unit economics are, than what investor I can get to give me money, right? And I think that switch in mindset, which we started, I would say almost 3 years ago, has helped us close where there's a lot of companies that haven't been able to close, you know, fundraising rounds.
Right. And now, of course, your model is proven, right?
Yes.
So what do you do about growth? Is growth inherently a good thing? Are you trying to go nationwide? I know you mentioned you don't necessarily want to hit every region within every state, but what's the goal then? Is it to grow geographically or into other sectors or what?
Yeah, so we have adopted a land and expand model. About maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we went national and it was painful. And so we were just like, okay, let's not do that again. And so now, you know, we've learned, right? So we will land in a certain area. We find out, because we do have some W-2 technicians and then we have partner organizations, we have to hit a certain minimum to be in a new territory. And then once we hit that minimum and then we stabilize, you know, those charging stations, meaning that we don't necessarily have to roll trucks out to it anymore, we can add more and more. And so that, strategy has been very helpful to us. So yeah, our goal is to be able to have a national offering. We've been working with more partner organizations that have labor in order to do that in a more strategic way. But I think our ultimate goal, honestly, when it comes down to it, is like, yes, we'll have reliability as a service, but we've built out an incredible technology back in and in the process of building out some very strong machine learning foundation that I think could be hopeful in a multitude of ways that we're excited to continue to explore.
Yeah. Before I really got to know you a little bit and your computer orientation, I was thinking, as I'm in the solar business, I was thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if you expanded into the solar O&M business and we're monitoring solar systems and certifying technicians and having people come out and repair systems?
Yeah, I mean, solar is cool, but I don't think it's as complex as I like. Like, I think solar typically, because it doesn't, you know, usually on like one house, like there's not multiple people interacting with it, but charging is very fascinating. So I think I'm just going to stay in.
Yeah, you like the complexity of the charging.
Oh, yeah.
And I had never thought about it. I mean, I think, you know, I was thinking in one dimension, which is that there's all these different chargers out there, different companies. I don't know how many, there's probably different 20 different companies or something like that. But then you've got all these different EVs that are plugging into those chargers. There's probably 100 different EV models now, and each EV is interacting differently with that charger, right?
Yes. And then you also have different credit card readers. Stations and cars operate on different telecom providers. You have different connector types. Oh, like the list goes, modem types, SIM cards. Like the, when you kind of map out the system that allows for there to be one successful charge, you're like, oh, yeah, like that's why it can break down.
Right.
Like there's a lot of failure points.
And then in terms of your organization, do you have people that specialize in these different areas?
So the great thing is that we have folks specialize in Open Charge Point Protocol, which that is the core charge management commands, you know, system for charging, control system. And so that's what we specialize in. We do get certified in different hardware. We are just now starting to get more in depth into battery management systems, so understanding those protocols.
And how many people do you have in your organization at this time?
We have about 41 people.
That's great. Good for you. Good for you.
It's expensive, Ted. But it is great.
You're still smiling, Camille. You're still smiling. And doing a great service. I mean, the more that we have companies like your company spreads, and the more we have companies like yours, the, like you said, the better the whole EV driving experience will be. What, how frustrating it is to pull up to a charger and then for it not to work. And of course, if there's only one or two chargers there, you're really in trouble.
1,000%. Yeah.
You co-founded this with, it must be a good friend or colleague. Is that person still with your organization?
Yes. And actually, the crazy thing is when I asked her to be my co-founder, we didn't even know each other. So it just worked out that she's still around. But we met through the LA Clean Tech Incubator. I had this wild idea that I started the company, and I was applying to a program that required you to have a co-founder, not knowing anything about tech companies, whatever have you, or even that Charger Hub will even be what it is today. I was like, oh, well, do you want to like do this thing with me? Because we were working on a project and somebody suggested I ask her. And at first she was like, no. My co-founder is Yvette. She's about 10 years older than me. Does not come from like this tech entrepreneur background. Both of her parents worked more so like buildings and the trades. She had worked for the Department of Labor all her life. And she was just like, man, like you're crazy. What do you mean we're going to not make any money for the first year and you have to go ask people for money? Do you have to give that money back? Like she was not gung-ho about it at all, but I convinced her and she's been with me now for the whole journey, which has been really cool.
That's a great story. That's a great story. And what do you do on a personal side? What do you do to keep balance in your life? Are you out there? You seem to have boundless energy. What do you do?
Oh,
to...
thanks. I mean, honestly, I'm just like, I have a very, very strong community. Like I am upset. I have three brothers that are younger than me. And I force them to hang out with me like as often as possible, specifically around holiday season. They all know that like once October hits into January, it's like family time. And I just plan a lot of events. And then I have a good group of like neighbors and friends that like, I can go to their house. We like to watch a lot of trash TV and I can just go to sleep and decompress. So I just think it's people. Like I've been very honored and grateful to have amazing humans in my life that just like continue to support me as I'm trying to do all these things.
Yeah, that really is. I don't know, I was going to say the bottom line, which sounds totally economic, but that is fundamentally the most heartfelt, the most important thing is the people that we surround ourselves with, right?
Absolutely.
And putting that good energy out there.
Yes.
And you're obviously solving a major problem, and your company is providing a really important service in this whole transition as we go green. So how cool.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time. It's great to meet you.
It's nice to be here. Thanks.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.